Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Today is Thursday, June 23rd, 2022. Now, a quick preview of the docket. Well, did the Supreme Court just give citizens a little more freedom, or did they create chaos? The abject failure of Uvalde, Dylan Rounds, maybe a little bit more to this story than what we're hearing thus far. Interesting developments in the Microsoft executive murder. This is why you don't touch other people's things. It can be unlawful and you can be prosecuted. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. So lately I've been trying to cut back on my Red Bull intake because I feel like lately it's been a little more difficult to fall asleep. And if you've been a fan for a while, you know that I also don't drink coffee. So I've been trying these little bottles of Magic Mind. So if you're like me and you don't like the crashes and jitters that come from coffee and Red Bull, then you have to try out my new favorite caffeine hack, Magic Mind. I love that they are small and easy to transport. I usually drink them on the way to work in the morning, and by the time I'm at my desk, I am ready to take on whatever craziness the world is going to throw at me. Magic Mind also has ashwagandha in it, which works to decrease stress, which certainly I can use a little of. And I'm looking into stocking the fridge here with Magic Mind so that my whole team can feel the benefits. So they gave me a great discount code. All you have to do is go to magicmind.co and use the code CT40, that's short for Crime Talk 40, for 40% off your first subscription. Or if you aren't into that, you can get 20% off your first purchase. I'll leave the notes in the show link. And the best part is that they have a money back guarantee, because you know it's always about the money. Go to www.magicmind.co/crimetalkdiscount code CT40. All right, aficionados, there was some big news from the United States Supreme Court today, and I want to go into it in a little more detail because a lot of the spin is going to come from both sides, saying that there's freedom given back to the citizen. Other people are going to say that this is great chaos that has been created by the Supreme Court by allowing more guns out there on the streets. You're going to have to decide for yourself, but I'm going to give you a little bit more information from the opinion itself so that you can make your own mind up. All right. So the Supreme Court has struck down a New York law that severely restricted licenses to carry a concealed weapon. Now, in the High Court's biggest Second Amendment ruling in more than a decade, the 6-3 ruling on Thursday reversed a lower court's opinion, which had upheld the 108-year-old New York law restricting licenses to carry concealed weapons in public to those demonstrating proper cause. Justice Clarence Thomas delivered the majority opinion, writing that the New York law prevents law-abiding citizens from exercising their Second Amendment rights. So let's discuss the facts. Now, the state of New York makes it a crime to possess a firearm without a license, whether inside or outside the home. Now, an individual who wants to carry a firearm outside his home may obtain an unrestricted license to have and carry a concealed pistol or revolver if he can prove, that's the key, if he can prove or she can prove that proper cause exists for doing so. An applicant satisfies the proper cause requirement only if the person can demonstrate a special need for self-protection distinguishable from the general community. Now, the petitioners in this case, Brandon Koch and Robert Nash, are adult, law-abiding New York residents who both applied for unrestricted licenses to carry a handgun in public based on their generalized interest in self-defense. The state denied both of their applications for unrestricted licenses, allegedly because Koch and Nash failed to satisfy the proper cause requirement. Petitioners then sued the respondents, the state officials who oversee the process of processing the licensing applications, for a declaratory and injunctive relief, alleging that the respondents violated their Second and 14th Amendment rights by denying their unrestricted license application for failure to demonstrate a unique need for self-defense. Now, the district court dismissed the petitioner's complaint, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. Both courts relied upon the Second Circuit's prior decision in a case called Keselowski versus County of Westchester, which had sustained New York's proper cause standard, holding that the requirement was substantially related to an achievement of an important governmental interest. So in the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Inc. versus Bruin, the New York's proper cause requirement violates the 14th Amendment, preventing law-abiding citizens and ordinary self-defense needs from exercising their Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms in public for self-defense. And the court relied upon their previous Supreme Court decision of the District of Columbia v. Heller and McDonald v. Chicago. The court held that the Second and 14th Amendments protects an individual right to keep and bear arms for self-defense. Now, under Heller, when the Second Amendment's plain text covers an individual conduct, the Constitution presumptively protects that conduct. And to justify a firearm regulation, the government must demonstrate that the regulation is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearms regulations. Now, since Heller and McDonald, the Court of Appeals have developed a two-step framework for analyzing Second Amendment challenges that combines history and means and scrutiny. The court rejects that two-part approach as having one step too many. Step one is broadly consistent with Heller, which demands a test rooted in the Second Amendment's text as informed by history. But Heller and McDonald do not support a second step that applies means and scrutiny in the Second Amendment context. And Heller's methodology centered on constitutional text and history. It did not invoke any means and test, such as a strict or intermediate scrutiny, and it expressly rejected an interest balancing inquiry akin to an intermediate scrutiny analysis. Now, a historical analysis can sometimes be difficult and nuanced, but reliance on history to inform the meaning of the constitutional text is more legitimate and more administratable than asking judges to make difficult empirical judgments about the cost and benefits of firearm restrictions, especially given the lack of expertise in the field. Now, federal courts tasked with making difficult empirical judgments regarding firearm regulations under the banner of intermediate scrutiny often defer to the determinations of legislators. While judicial deference to legislative interest balancing is understandable and elsewhere appropriate, it is not deference that the Constitution demands here, the court writes. The Second Amendment is the very product of an interesting balancing by the people, and it surely elevates above all other interests that have the rights of law-abiding citizens, responsible citizens, to use arms for self-defense. And they cited the Heller opinion. The test that the court set forth in Heller and applies today requires the court to assess whether modern firearms regulations are consistent with the Second Amendment's text and historical understanding. Of course, the regulatory challenges posed by firearms today are not always the same as those preoccupying the founders in 1791 or the Reconstruction generation in 1868. But the court notes that the Constitution can and must apply to circumstances beyond those the founders specifically anticipated, even though its meaning is mixed according to the understanding of those who ratified it. So indeed, the court recognized in Heller at least one way in which the Second Amendment's historically fixed meaning applies to new circumstances. Its references to arms does not apply, only to those arms in existence in the 18th century. Now, to determine whether a firearm regulation is consistent with the Second Amendment, Heller and McDonald point towards at least two relevant metrics. First, whether modern and historical regulations impose a comparable burden on the right of armed self-defense, and second, whether that regulatory burden is comparably justified. Because individual self-defense is the central component of the Second Amendment right, These two metrics are central considerations when engaging in analogical inquiry. To be clear, even if a modern-day regulation is not a dead ringer for historical precursors, it still may be analogous enough to pass constitutional muster. For example, courts can use analogies to long-standing laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places, such as schools and government buildings, to determine whether a modern regulation are constitutionally permissible. That said, the respondents' attempt to characterize New York's proper cause requirement as a sensitive place law lacks merit because there is no historical basis for New York to effectively declare the island of Manhattan a sensitive place simply because it is crowded and protected generally by the New York City Police Department. Having made the constitutional standard endorsed in Heller more explicit, the court applies that standards to New York's proper clause requirement. Now, it is undisputed that the petitioners, Koch and Nash, two ordinary law-abiding adult citizens, are part of the people whom the Second Amendment protects. And no party disputes that handguns are weapons in the common use today for self-defense. The court has little difficulty concluding that the plain text of the Second Amendment protects Koch and Nash's proposed course of conduct, carrying handguns publicly for self-defense. Nothing in the Second Amendment text draws a home/public distinction with respect to the right and keep and bear arms, and the definition of bear naturally encompasses public carry. Moreover, the Second Amendment guarantees an individual right to possess and carry weapons in case of confrontation, and confrontation can surely take place outside the home. So, the burden then falls on the respondents, New York, to show that the New York proper cause requirement is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearms regulation. To do so, the respondents appeal to a variety of historical sources from the late 1200s to 1900s. But when it comes to interpreting the Constitution, not all history is created equal. Constitutional rights are enshrined with the scope they were understood to have when people adopted them. The Second Amendment was adopted in 1791, the 14th in 1868. Historical evidence that long predates and postdates either time may not illuminate the scope of the right. With these principles in mind, the court concludes that respondents have failed to meet their burden to identify the American tradition justifying New York's proper clause requirement. And respondents' substantial reliance on English history and the custom before the founding making some sense given Heller's statement that the Second Amendment codified a right inherited from our English ancestors. But the court finds that the history ambiguous at best and sees little reason to think that the framers would have thought it be applicable in the New World. The court cannot conclude from this historical reference that by the time of the founding, English law would have justified restricting the right to publicly bear arms suited for self-defense only to those who demonstrated some special need for self-protection. Respondents next direct the court to the history of the colonies and early republic, but they identify only three restrictions on public carry from that time. While the court doubts that just three colonial regulations could suffice to show a tradition of public carry regulation, even looking at these laws on their own terms, the court was not convinced that they regulated public carry akin to the New York law at issue. The statutes essentially prohibiting bearing arms in a way that spread fear or terror among the people, including by carrying of a dangerous and unusual weapon. Whatever the likelihood that the handguns were considered dangerous and unusual during the colonial period, they are today the quintessential self-defense weapon. Thus, these colonial laws provide no justification for laws restricting the public carry of weapons that are unquestionably in common use today. Only after the ratification of the Second Amendment in 1791 did public carry restrictions proliferate. Respondents rely heavily on these restrictions, which generally fell into three categories: common law offenses, statutory prohibitions, and surety statutes. Now, none of these restrictions imposed a substantial burden on the public carry analogous to that imposed by the New York's restrictive licensing regime. Offenses. As during the colonial and founding periods, the common law offenses of affray, or going armed to the terror of the people, continued to impose some limits on firearm carry in the antebellum period. But there is no evidence indicating that these common law limitations impaired the right of the general population to peacefully public carry. Now, in the early to mid 19th century, some states began enacting laws that prescribed the concealed carry of pistols and other small weapons, but the antebellum state court decisions upholding them evince a consensus view that the states could not altogether prohibit the public carry of arms protected by the Second Amendment or the state analogous. In the mid-19th century, many jurisdictions began adopting laws that required certain individuals to post bonds before carrying weapons in public. Now, contrary to the respondents' positions, these surety statutes in no way represented direct precursors to New York's proper cause requirement. Now, while New York presumes that individuals have no public carry right without a showing of heightened need, the surety statutes presume that the individuals had a right to public carry that could be burdened only if another could make out a specific showing of reasonable cause of fear or injury or breach of the peace. Thus, unlike New York's regime, a showing of special need was required only after an individual was reasonably accused of intending to injure another or breach the peace. And even then, proving special need simply avoided a fee. In sum, the historical evidence from the antebellum America does demonstrate that the manner of public carry was subject to reasonable regulation, but none of the limitations on the right to bear arms operated to prevent law-abiding citizens with ordinary self-defense needs from carrying arms in public for that purpose. Evidence from around the adoption of the 14th Amendment does not support respondents' position either. The discussion of the right to keep and bear arms in Congress and in public discourse as people debated whether and how to secure constitutional rights for newly free slaves generally demonstrates that during the Reconstruction, the right to keep and bear arms had limits that were consistent with a right of the public to peacefully carry handguns for self-defense. The court acknowledges two Texas cases that approved a statutory reasonable grounds standard for public carry analogous to New York's proper cause requirements, but these decisions were outliers and therefore provide little insight into how post-bellum courts view the right to carry protected arms in public. Finally, respondents point to the slight uptick in gun regulations during the late 19th century. And as this court suggested in Heller, however, late 19th century evidence cannot provide much insight into the meaning of the Second Amendment when it contradicts earlier evidence. In addition, the vast majority of the statutes that respondents invoke come from the Western territories. The bare existence of these localized restrictions cannot overcome the overwhelming evidence of an otherwise enduring American tradition permitting public carry. Moreover, these territorial laws were rarely subject to judicial scrutiny, and absent any evidence explaining why these unprecedented prohibitions on all public carry were understood to comport with the Second Amendment, they do little to inform the origins and continuing significance of the amendment. Finally, these territorial restrictions deserve little weight because they were consistent with the transitory nature of territorial government, short-lived. Some were held unconstitutional shortly after passage, and others did not survive a territory admission to the Union as a state. And after reviewing the Anglo-American history of public carry, the court concludes that respondents have not met their burden to identify an American tradition justifying New York's proper cause requirement. Apart from a few late 19th century outlier jurisdictions, American governments simply have not broadly prohibited the public carry of commonly used firearms for personal defense, nor have they generally required law-abiding, responsible citizens to demonstrate a special need for self-protection distinguishable from that of the general community to carry arms in public. The constitutional right to bear arms in public for self-defense is not a second-class right, subject to an entirely different body of rules than the other Bill of Rights guarantees, the court notes. The exercise of other constitutional rights does not require individuals to demonstrate to government officers some special need. The Second Amendment right to carry arms is in public for self-defense is no different. New York's proper cause requirement violates the 14th Amendment by preventing law-abiding citizens with ordinary self-defense needs from exercising their right to keep and bear arms in public. Now, I know that was lengthy, but that's the gist of the court's ruling in this particular case. And what you can glean from it is that nowhere traditionally, historically in the United States have they banned public carry for law-abiding citizens. At most, you could say, is that somebody needed a surety, a bond, basically an insurance policy, if somebody who had already been aggressive had to come forward and wanted to prevent a bond, basically like an insurance policy. The court rejects that. We've talked about this before. The government has a duty to protect your rights. The government's job is to protect your rights, not to take them away. And the court, some will argue, gave the people, at least in New York and other states that have similar restrictive firearm restrictions, some of their liberty back, their freedom back. Others will argue that it'll be complete chaos because there'll be people out there with guns and dogs and cats will be getting along and it'll just be complete chaos. Truth be told, we're going to have to wait and see. But the court did note in concurring opinions by Chief Justice Roberts, as well as Gorsuch, that this does not prevent people from still having to go through some reasonable steps to include a background check, mental health evaluation, and perhaps a proficiency test to obtain or carry a firearm in public. And of course, it can always be limited to government offices and things of that nature. But what it does show is you shouldn't have to ask the government to exercise your constitutional right. Let me know what you think in the comments. I know it was a little long, but I think it's worth noting because, well, it was a huge decision from the United States Supreme Court. Next on the docket, Uvalde. Well, the school district police chief, Pete Arredondo, was put on administrative leave Wednesday as allegations intensify that his response to the Robb Elementary mass shooting was an abject failure, something that we have called it for sure. Because audio and video of the scene show Arredondo giving orders and other officers to wait for an order to breach the classroom for more than an hour. Now, the Uvalde Consolidated Independent School District Superintendent Hal Harrell said he decided to put Arredondo on leave because investigators who testified about the response this week at the State Senate Committee hearing have been unclear about what happened that day. Now, Harrell said from the beginning of this horrible event, he shared that the district would wait until the investigation was complete before making personnel decisions. Because of the lack of clarity and the unknown timing of when he'll receive the results of the investigation, he decided to place Chief Arredondo on administrative leave effective immediately. Harrell's decision came a day after the Uvalde City Council unanimously denied Arredondo's request for a leave of absence from his duty as the council member. As you may recall, he was sworn in as a council member, city council, in secret just days after the massacre. The Texas Department of Public Safety Chief Colonel Stephen McGraw told the state committee that sufficient law enforcement was on site and ready to breach the classroom where the gunman Salvador Ramos, absolute coward, was within minutes of his arrival there. Yet Arredondo was on the phone requesting more personnel and more arms, even as students inside the classroom called 911 and begged for help. Arredondo says he knew nothing about this because he left behind his radio. No order to breach the classroom came for 77 minutes when Arredondo said that a tactical team could go in if they were ready. Now, Uvalde Mayor McLaughlin is backing Arredondo, accusing state agencies of putting out false information and calling the Senate hearing a clown show. The Uvalde School District's officials didn't say if Arredondo would be paid while he's on leave. Of course he will. Harrell said that other officers in the six-member department would take over his duties. Abject failure, resign. Just resign. Maybe they could call, do a recall petition as well. Just to get him out of there. Just saying. All right. Remember to like the video, subscribe if you have not, and hit that little bell so that you get notifications when we go live or put up new content. We do appreciate it. Next, Dylan Rounds. I don't think this case is exactly what a lot of people in the media are making it out to be, but I think we'll have some new information. So we'll give you the story today, but we may have something coming up here in the next day or so. Well, the FBI is now involved in the case of missing 19-year-old Dylan Rounds, who disappeared from a remote farm near the Utah-Nevada border about a month ago. Now, Dylan's grandmother spoke to him on Saturday, May 28th, but no one has heard from him since. And according to his parents, there have been no signs of Rounds anywhere and no activity on his cell phone or his bank account. Dylan's mother and father sat down for their first joint interview since their son vanished. Dylan's father, Justin Rounds, said the main goal is to find Dylan. That's the first and only priority. But the other goal is to find out who did what and make sure that they get coming to them what the law requires. Now, Candace Cooley, Dylan's mother, said that when they hadn't heard from him by May 29th, she went to his farm and other family members as well, but found nothing out of place or suspicious. They figured maybe after putting his grain truck away, might he broken his leg, maybe he was bit by a snake, but didn't see any signs of a struggle. The family members searched the property, and 90 minutes later, Dylan's boots were found behind a pile of dirt about 300 yards from the grain truck. The boots were found in the opposite direction, as if he was walking towards his camper, according to Ms. Cooley, and his boots were found with a dark substance on them, which the family thought was probably grease or oil. Investigators told them that it was blood, but it could have been from an animal. Now, while the family has received tips from people around the world about Dylan, where he could be, they've had to deal a lot with misinformation about the case. Strangers have set up a online fundraiser using Dylan's name and pictures, but his parents say those are not official, so don't donate. The family's not created any GoFundMe accounts or asked for any monetary donations. They want to stress that they are not working with any private investigators, just law enforcement. The Box Elder County Sheriff's Office in Utah has assigned every detective to Dylan's case, according to the Deputy Chief Cade Palmer. Teams have been in this area almost every day, but so far there's no solid leads. Rounds' parents are offering a $20,000 reward to anyone who finds him or knows where he might be. If you have any information, please contact the Box Elder Sheriff's Office at 435-734-3800. May have more coming to you on that here soon. Remember, you can listen to Crime Talk anytime on the go by listening to any of your favorite podcasting apps. That includes Audible, iHeartRadio, Apple, and Spotify. All right, remember that Microsoft executive murder? Well, we have an update. So Shanna Fernandez, the ex-wife of the Microsoft executive Jared Brigden, that was shot and killed in front of his two-year-old daughter, was allegedly asking employees at a tattoo shop in 2015 if she knew anyone who could, quote, shut him up, end quote. In 2015, Brigden and Fernandez were divorced, but were still living together. The employee at the tattoo parlor said that Fernandez came into the shop to get a piercing on her private parts and that the two became friends. They went out to dinner at the restaurant in Jacksonville, Florida, and the anonymous employee recalls. She had been talking to us about her divorce, and she told us her life could just be better if he could just shut up, and asked us if we knew anybody that could shut him up. The employee said that they did not take it as nefarious at the time, but of course, in hindsight, he sees how it can be taken differently now. Detectives interviewed the employee last week, who added that Fernandez often complained that Brigden was trying to take all of her money. He also recalled thinking it was strange for a mother her age to get a piercing in her vajayjay. He said, "I just remember thinking, well, this is a changed woman." Fernandez and her new husband recently hired an attorney, as the murder of her ex-husband remains unsolved. The legal move comes as investigators heavily scrutinized Fernandez and Brigden's relationship after the father of four was gunned down on February 16th, with new details about the couple's messy split. Now, Fernandez is the daughter of Sterling and Shelley Gardner, who co-founded the company Stampin' Up, which is valued at roughly about $100 million. In 2015, the marriage began to fall apart while the couple was living in Florida, and Fernandez accused Brigden of threatening to withdraw from their children's trust fund for his own use and spying on her with their twin babies' monitors. Brigden said that he was just fighting for custody, alimony, and child support. Brigden added that Fernandez had allegedly canceled an important heart surgery appointment for their son in 2015. Brigden and Fernandez were both remarried at the time of Brigden's murder, but still going through a messy legal battle over the children. Brigden was shot multiple times at close range next to the driver door of his car with his two-year-old daughter from the new marriage in the back seat. The brutal crime sent shockwaves through the quiet Florida beach town, and Brigden's friends and family expressing profound shock that anyone should have targeted the man who they say had no enemies. Here's one woman that truly believes in self-defense and self-defense of others. A Texas woman by the name of Stephanie Toole is behind bars for allegedly killing her husband, but she says she isn't sorry about it. Toole, who's 37, has been charged with murder concerning the death of her husband, Joe Abril, 58. Police were dispatched to the home in Odessa, where they found Joe Abril inside the residence, bleeding from numerous gunshot wounds. Police questioned Stephanie Toole, who allegedly admitted to shooting her husband. "I wish I was sorry, but I'm not," Toole reportedly said while police read Miranda rights to her. "No one messes with my kids." Now, reports say that Toole called 911 herself around 6:20 p.m. First responders rushed the victim to the hospital, where he was pronounced dead. Toole remains behind bars without bail. No further information as to what she meant by "nobody messes with my kids," but I think we can reasonably interpret what that probably means. All right, this is why you don't mess with other people's things. It's unlawful. Remember the Florida teen party that we brought you a couple of days ago? Well, the owner of the $8 million mansion in Florida that was taken over by teens for a mega house party wants the teens, each and every one of them, prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. She said, "criminally, civilly, all of it. Their parents should hold them accountable. If they don't, we will." The victim, who lives in Watercolor, Florida, with her husband and two small kids, said the family was out of town when cops called to ask if she was aware of a party in progress at her home. She stated that she was shocked. She recalled her initial reaction. "It was a feeling of disgust that kids would do that. We lived in this community for 6 years. We raised their own kids there, and the homeowner suspected that the teenagers saw their home was up for sale and targeted it for this rager party." She said that she also has two older kids who don't live at the home anymore and did not recognize any of the partiers from the photos or videos collected by the police. Now, these teens allegedly ransacked the house while blasting music, boozing, and even setting up a boxing ring in the living room. Cops say that they also tried on designer clothes they found in the closets and made off with some expensive souvenirs, including a signed Peyton Manning football and a bottle of wine. Neighbors and friends helped clean up the mess before the family arrived home, filling up 10 trash bags in the process. They also changed the sheets on all of the beds in the home. The homeowners ended with, "the community is outraged. I don't know about what these kids thought, that they could just walk into somebody's home and do this, and they are not going to stand for it." Well, as soon as they said that they stole the Peyton Manning football that was signed by Peyton Manning, all these children should be sentenced. You don't mess with another man's Peyton Manning football. Seriously, it just makes you wonder, what kind of society are we living in? Kids thought they could go into somebody else's house, party it up without permission, commit a burglary, commit crime in the residence, and that no one should face any consequences. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe parents need to start being parents again and stop being worried about being their kid's best friend. Finally, our dumb criminal comes from the great state of Colorado. A drunk Colorado man by the name of Jeremiah Taylor broke into an unstaffed Park County Sheriff's Station and stole a 2013 Dodge Durango. Now, Park County is kind of on the backside of Summit County, which is the backside of like where Keystone Ski Resorts are. It's very rural area. Now, the police say that Taylor then drove the stolen car to nearby Teller County after officials broadcasted a domestic violence incident on the police radio. Residents from the location of the call said Taylor walked up to them, appearing drunk, identified himself as a deputy, and asked, "Where's the old man that's going to shoot someone?" He was arrested 2 hours later after he led police on a 110-mile-an-hour police chase, crashed the stolen car, and ran into the woods. Taylor was hit with 8 charges, including aggravated motor vehicle theft. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Colorado. Steal the car while you're drunk on a 110-mile chase. I had a guy do that once in Teller County. On a motorcycle, though. But they still caught him. That's dumb. You can't really run from the police. All right, let's go ahead and close the docket for today. I know it was a long one, but I hope you enjoyed it. Some important information, and you need to have the facts as to what the analysis was. The court came to that important decision today. All right, thanks for watching. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you next time.